of the day, Local 15, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus the NLRB.
Risky business.
Ms. Teitelbaum?
May it please the court, my name is Marilyn Teitelbaum and I represent the petitioner in this case. I think this is a very important case. If the decision is allowed to stand, employers will be free to have carte blanche over lockouts and who they lock out, including lockouts based upon the extent of participation in Section 7 activities, which is the case we have here. The board justifies this by stating nothing in the law requires an employer to exercise the maximum economic pressure. And the company claims it has a right to favor the non-strikers and the crossovers. If this decision stands, an employer can, in fact, pick and choose between who to lock out and who not to lock out based upon their assessment of who supports the union and who does not support the union. And this assessment could be based, like in this situation, on union activities, or it could be based upon participation on the union negotiating team or other like factors. This is not a complicated case. Unfortunately, I think that the board and the employer in this case have complicated the issues by mischaracterization of the facts and evidence, which shouldn't happen in this case because we have a stipulated record. There's really no room for massaging the facts, and nobody should be massaging the facts before this court. And more importantly, the board should not be allowed, as they did here, to base their decisions on speculation and, quote, self-evident truths. And the board actually referred to certain self-evident truths in its decision. Today I want to focus on trying to separate fact from fiction in two crucial areas, one of it which is the conduct, which is actually an issue in this case, and the second is the record evidence of legitimate and substantial business justification. First of all, the lockout and the reason for it is not at issue here. You see lots in the briefs of the employer and the board about it. It's not at issue here. There is no issue with respect to the right of the employer to further its bargaining position by a lockout. That was established long ago in American Ship. We're not here to contest that, as we couldn't anyway. What's at issue here is the institution of a partial lockout drawn along Section 7 activity lines. In the Section 7 activity lines, I'm sure it's repeated many times in our briefs, to understand is what the company did is they, anybody that gave up their right individually to strike prior to August 31st when the members jointly or collectively gave up their right to strike. Anybody that did it individually before August 31st were not locked out. Anybody that eschewed it after August 31st, they were locked out. And including who were locked out is six, or were not locked out, are six employees that hadn't even been worked back into the workforce, but sometime right before the August 31st membership vote, they, in fact, offered to come back individually, and they were worked into the workforce after the vote to go back to work. Now, as the board admits, the company's drawing the line as it did is unlawful discrimination unless the company proves it had a legitimate and substantial business reason for doing so. We disagree. They applied the comparatively slight test. We think the inherently destructive test was applicable. But under either test, that once you show there is an impact, then the burden shifts to prove to the company to prove a substantial and legitimate business reason for doing so. What I suggest to you is the record is absolutely devoid of any evidence of a substantial and legitimate business reason for the employer drawing the line it did. Certainly, if in fact there is no record evidence and the company has not met its burden of proof, then the union is not obligated to prove anti-union animus. It stops there.
Counsel, would you address the language in the S-Mark case on the issue of the scope of the inherently destructive test?
Okay.
And the distinction drawn there between process and substance, because I think that's critical for the resolution of this appeal.
Well, as I understand the S-Mark case, I apologize, I don't have it right here in front of me. As I understand the S-Mark case, that when lines are drawn based upon participation or lack of participation, because of its effect upon exercise of Section 7 rights by drawing a line like that, it in fact is inherently destructive. Now, I understand that there was language about in that and a number of other cases about the difference, in fact, American Ship, about the difference between the process of collective bargaining agreement. But, and I've tried to understand how those fit into, in the exact same case in American Ship, it talks about, but here there was no discrimination based upon union activities. The SIPs case, too, the board specifically found, in I'm talking about Local 702 SIPs case, specifically found that there it was a lockout of the whole unit. There was no discrimination based upon Section 7 activities. So to the extent that a line is drawn, we have a partial lockout, and the line is drawn based upon Section 7 activities or less than a full lockout of the whole bargaining unit based upon Section 7 activities, that is, it has been traditionally held to be inherently destructive of important Section 7 rights. And I think one of the case is the Bally Bynes case and the Liquid Gas case, both of which are cited in the board's decisions case. That's sort of set the standard. It says when you have a partial lockout, you've got to have a really good business justification for it because it is so inherently destructive of rights. Now, that wasn't I'm not suggesting that was inherently destructive case, but because of the effect on the bargaining unit, it says that you have to have a substantial legitimate business reason for it. In terms of, but it seems to me that we never get to any of those questions. We don't have to get to that because if it's in fact even comparably slight, as the board acknowledges in this case, then the employer must prove some substantial legitimate business justification. And there is none in the record. The employer and the board, you know, states that there is various ones, and I want to sort of run through those real quick. The first one is to further their company's bargaining position. The only evidence on furthering the company's bargaining position is in Joint Exhibit 9, which is referred to in Stipulation 32. And what that says, and that's the only potential reason at all for the lockout, drawing the lines, or whatever, it says striking employees cannot return to work until there's a new contract. That is a statement of the reason for the lockout. It's not a statement of the reason for drawing the line where they did in this case, and that's what needs to be justified. Thereafter, in that Joint Exhibit 9, after that statement I just read, it says that mentions those who return to work or scheduled to return to work prior to August 31st will be allowed to work. It does not state any reason why they're going to allow these people to work and the others not. Even if the record did reflect that drawing the line was done to further the bargaining position, however, that itself would be unlawful. And if you just think about it, how would not locking out the non-strikers and the crossovers further the company's position? The only way it would further the company's position is because it would send that unlawful message, as mentioned in McGuire, as mentioned in Thrift Drug, the unlawful message that if you stick with the union to the end, you will not have work. If you give up your rights before, abandon the union, you will have work. Now, when I say this, abandon the union, it gets us into another reason that they gave.
You're under your rebuttal, you understand.
Oh, I'm sorry. No. Thank you.
Well, you may finish your thought. It's your time.
I don't want to use up the rebuttal, but okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kappas?
Yes. I'm here for the United Steelworkers as amicus curiae in support of the petitioner. And I do think that the S-Mark case and the analysis there of this issue is really the key to deciding this case. And what the court says in S-Mark is that the employer's substantive bargaining position and furthering that can be a justification for adverse action against the employees, but only insofar as the employer has acted in accord with respecting the employee's rights to engage in concerted activity. And the court then goes on to explain that if the employer is engaged in an inherently destructive activity, that is not acting in accord with the employee's rights to engage in concerted activity. And then further, the court identifies as one species of inherently destructive employer behavior, singling out employees based on engaging in protected activity, in particular engaging in a strike. So that's precisely what we have in this case. The employer has targeted the people who remained on strike and with the purpose of bringing pressure to bear on them, and that is the sort of activity that this court has held will inevitably discourage people from engaging in that activity in the future.
The problem I have with this argument, counsel, is that it's sort of all or nothing. It would seem to me that if we accept your position here and the position of the union, that all partial lockouts are illegal.
No, that's not true. A partial lockout where the line is drawn based on engaging in protected activity is unlawful. But a partial lockout where the line is drawn on some other basis, for instance, the type of workers that possess a certain skill to keep the plant open or some other neutral basis, would be permissible. But it is impermissible to target a group because they've engaged in protected activity.
Well, let me rephrase the question then, because I see the point that you're driving at. But a partial lockout that excludes anybody who came back to work voluntarily before the lockout was declared is per se illegal.
Only if the exclusion is based on
something
on the protected activity. I mean, if they had come forward with a more neutral reason, like these people are part of our active team running the plant or something like that, we'd have a different case. But
well,
that's not
why
what
isn't that a
here.
Logical inference from the factual stipulations here?
Well, because in fact, some of the people they allowed to come back had not begun work. They had merely come forward and abandoned the strike, but they hadn't actually started work.
Well, they were scheduled to.
Pardon me?
They were scheduled to.
The only thing that distinguished them from the strikers was they gave up earlier.
Okay.
And the board says that that's the line. The justification the board hypothesizes is the strikers are the people that need to be brought to heel. And that is just simply, that rationale would justify locking out the union membership or the union officers or the bargaining committee. I mean, they all could be viewed rationally as the people you need to pressure, but that's precisely what the statute prohibits. If there are no questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Goldstein.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Goldstein, attorney for the National Labor Relations Board. The board found that the company did not violate the act by refusing to reinstate and locking out those employees who were on an economic strike at the time of the union's unconditional offer to return to work. And the question before the court is whether the board had a rational basis for that finding. Now, it's well settled that an employer does not violate the act if it refuses to reinstate economic strikers, so long as it has a legitimate and substantial business justification for its refusal. And here the board plainly had a rational basis because the stipulated record shows that the company refused to reinstate these strikers for the legitimate purpose of applying pressure in support of its bargaining demands. Thus, the company told the union in its September 6 letter announcing the lockout that the striking employees would not be allowed to return to work until a new contract was ratified, and then the company lived up to its word and ended the lockout once the employees did ratify a new contract, and the union stipulated here that the company bargained in good faith. Now, the union argues that the company refused to reinstate the strikers not for the purpose of getting a new contract, but instead for the purpose of punishing the employees for exercising their Section 7 rights to strike. But there's no direct evidence to support that proposition, and all the circumstantial evidence cuts the other way. First, the company acted at all times consistently with its stated goal of trying to get a new contract. Before it implemented the lockout, the company treated employees who exercised their Section 7 rights to strike, but who then sought to return to work, precisely the same as employees who never struck at all. So if, as the union claims, the company was hell-bent on punishing employees for exercising their Section 7 rights to strike, it's difficult to understand why it would have reinstated every single one of the strikers who sought to return to work before it implemented the lockout. The company also never bothered to exercise its right to hire permanent replacements. And finally, the record contains positive evidence of the company's good faith, which tends to rebut the union's claim that the lockout was unlawfully motivated. This stipulated record shows that the company bargained in good faith throughout the course of the negotiations. And finally, as the board noted, it wasn't necessary for the company to lock out the non-strikers and the employees who returned to work before the lockout in order to achieve its bargaining goals, because those employees had already eschewed the strike weapon during the strike. Indeed, the union's brief to the board admitted that those non-strikers and the employees who abandoned the strike early had demonstrated a lack of continuing support for the union. And it's important to note that a strike is economic warfare. The union started this. They went out on strike to apply pressure to force the company to capitulate to the union's bargaining demands. The non-strikers and the employees who crossed over the picket line early, not only had those employees removed themselves from the union's application of economic force against the company, but in fact they were helping the company weather the union's application of economic warfare by returning to work and helping the employer continue operations. There were 8 non-strikers and there were 47 crossovers. It's undisputed that the company took them back to work. The company wasn't just paying them to sit at home. That was 55, if my math is right, that was 55 replacements that the company didn't have to go out and hire. And as the board explained in Tidewater, if the rationale underlying the allowance of a lockout is to put pressure on the employees to accept the bargaining demands, it would hardly serve that purpose to require the employer to lock out the employees who worked despite the strike. And there's also no merit to the union's claim that proof of anti-union animus was unnecessary here because the company's conduct was inherently destructive. As this court noted in the S-Mark case and as the D.C. Circuit explained in the Boilermakers case, inherently destructive conduct is generally conduct that creates continuing obstacles to the future exercise of employee rights. In other words, an eerie resistor, the employer granted super seniority to the strike replacements. When that strike ended, an eerie resistor, the replacements still had super seniority, and that would continue into perpetuity. So 10 years after that strike ended, an eerie resistor, if the employer's demand, if their customer orders declined and the employer had to engage in an economic lockout and it did it by seniority, the strike replacements who got super seniority were going to have priority over the union stalwarts. And that served as a continuing reminder of the dangers of exercising the rights to strike. The conduct in this case that is at issue, this lockout, is completely different. It was conduct of temporary duration. Once the employees capitulated and ratified the new contract, the lockout ended, and every single striker that sought to return to work was able to.
Counsel, do you think the board's decision in this case establishes the opposite sort of per se rule than what I was referring to earlier, essentially a rule that a partial lockout drawn along striker, non-striker lines is per se or always legal?
I don't think it does. I mean, the board is unique among administrative agencies in that it hardly ever engages in rulemaking. It issues all its pronouncements through case-by-case adjudication, and therefore, like a court, its rulings ought to be interpreted as, you know, confined to their facts. I mean, the board's decision in this case is consistent with two cases, Tidewater and Acker Concepts, where the board found that based on those facts, an employer does not engage in inherently destructive conduct by locking out employees in support of its bargaining demand merely because after the lockout it retained workers who returned to work before the lockout. But if the employer had conditioned reinstatement before the lockout on an employee's resigning from the union, then that would be unlawful. So there's certainly no per se rule here. And as to this argument that, you know, because this conduct does have a tendency to discourage union activity, and this argument that the strikers, as of August 31st, had eschewed the strike weapon, that argument, it proves too much. There's no limiting principle. I mean, every lockout in support of bargaining demands where the employer continues to operate does draw a distinction based on Section 7 activity. An employer never locks out the non-union employees because it doesn't have to get its bargaining demands implemented. Non-union employees don't have a right to bargain collectively. The employer can unilaterally set their terms and conditions of employment. So it never locks out the non-unit employees. And during an economic strike, an employer can permanently replace the economic strikers, even if it doesn't do it all at once. And so what that means is that at the end of an economic strike, you often have a situation where the people who are working are the people who never struck at all, or the people who abandoned the strike early and got back to work before they were permanently replaced. And the people who aren't working, unfortunately, are the people who stayed out on strike until the union ended and can't come back to work because they were permanently replaced. That employer action clearly can be said to draw a distinction based on how long the employees engaged in the Section 7 activity. If you engaged in it until the end and you were permanently replaced, you're not coming back. If you never engaged in it, or you engaged in it just for a short period of time and then sought to come back, you are working. Yet that clearly is lawful. It's been the law since I believe 1935, and even the union concedes that's lawful. So the question isn't whether the employer drew a distinction. Instead, the question is, did the employer have a legitimate and substantial business justification for refusing to reinstate the employees it actually did refuse to reinstate? And this employer did. It told the union why they weren't going to be allowed to come back to work, namely that they couldn't come back until they ratified a new contract. And then the company's actions, you know, spoke louder than its words. Once the union capitulated, they all came back.
Mr. Goldstein, the majority opinion suggests, and I quote, "It's self-evident that respondents' retention of the crossover employees and non-strikers during the lockout augmented its effort to maintain continued production." I find no allegation in the record that that is true. In the stipulated facts, I find the company admits that it successfully maintained operations through the efforts of supervisory personnel, contractors, and some temporary replacements. Now, my question to you is, nowhere in the facts does Midwest claim that it relied on non-strikers or crossovers to maintain operations. Do you find a weakness in the analysis of the majority here?
Well, the factual predicate for the board's somewhat conclusory assertion is that the stipulation states that there were 8 non-strikers and then there were 47 crossovers. And the stipulation does say, I believe as the union conceded this today, that the employer accepted them back to work. Now, as a matter of law, since McKay, if an employer accepts them back to work, in other words, isn't just paying them to sit at home, by definition, if they're working, that's 55 less replacements that the employer has to go out and hire. And there's never been any Supreme Court precedent for the proposition that an employer is only allowed to take them back or only allowed to hire permanent replacements if it can show that it was absolutely essential for the employer to do that in order to continue operating.
No, I'm just questioning the underlying factual basis for the conclusion drawn by the board. I mean, when I find unease there, it causes me sometimes to examine other premises and conclusions, even though we allegedly have stipulations here that...
Well, I
just think it's an
overstatement.
Appears to me by the board here.
Right. conclusion, the board requests that the court deny the union's petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Mr. Moritz.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jeremy Moritz, and I'm counsel for the intervener in this matter, Midwest Generation. With me at counsel table is Julia Albans. I want to pick up on a couple phrases thrown around here. You know, the allegation that the company drew the line based on concerted activity or protected concerted activity is simply an oversimplification. The vast majority of the crossover employees had also engaged in strike activity. Protected activity at some point, only later to abandon it. So it's not enough to simply say, look, you're drawing the lines based on Section 7 activity. It's important to look at the purpose and the effect behind that activity. You have one group of employees who, by abandoning an ongoing strike, are offering to help the company weather the union's economic action. You have a second group of employees who, as of August 31st, are offering to return to work, but offering to return without agreeing to the company's lawful bargaining proposals. The first situation, as the first group of employees, the company clearly has an interest in retaining its own employees, particularly in its most dire circumstances, in the situation where it is doing everything it can to maintain production and maintain operations. As to the second, that is a tactical move. They're returning without agreeing to the company's lawful bargaining proposals. They're not returning to help the company weather a strike. In fact, there is no strike anymore. They may be returning for a variety of reasons, either because the economic impact is too much and they simply need a paycheck. Perhaps they're returning to engage in inside game pressure tactics. Perhaps they intend to strike again next summer, which of course would not be prohibited given that there is not a collective bargaining agreement and a no strike clause in place. But none of that, you know, really answers the question. The key point, the key distinction between these two groups of employees is that one, the first group, the crossover group, took an action that clearly was contrary to the union's strike objectives and also clearly assisted the company in weathering the strike. The second group of employees was still engaged in a bargaining tactic, a different form, but was offering to return to work without agreeing to lawful proposals. On the inherently destructive conduct test, I just want to point out the company's actions in this case clearly does not meet that standard. The company could have used permanent replacements prior to August 31st, and the end result of this action would be that strikers could not return to work after the strike ended, and in fact would not be reinstated until the permanent replacements either resigned or were terminated. Had the company taken advantage of this perfectly legal tactic, the strikers would have suffered much more serious and much longer lingering adverse job effects than what occurred in this case. But the company didn't exercise that right. Instead, all of the company's decisions preserved bargaining unit positions for bargaining unit employees, including striking employees. And the union's legal theory simply breaks down when you consider that even permanent replacement of strikers does not constitute inherently destructive conduct. As to the S-mark test, I mean, as I read S-mark, the first question is whether the company's actions illustrated hostility towards the bargaining process or merely sought to further its substantive bargaining proposals. Clearly, the company's actions did not illustrate hostility to the bargaining process. It is undisputed the company bargained in good faith throughout this entire period. As the board points out in its decision, there is ample evidence of other good faith compliance with union information requests throughout the record. Second, the employer must respect employees' rights under Section 7. Again, Section 7 protects two rights, both the right to engage in protected concerted activity and the right to refrain from that activity. It is not a one-way street, and the board's decision properly strikes that balance. The company took no action that interfered with the right to strike. We did not offer additional enhancements to crossovers, super seniority, pay out vacation to one group but not the other. We took none of those actions. The final S-mark factor is permanent versus temporary effects. And again, on this point, the company could have taken a lawful permanent replacement tactic, which would have had much longer, much longer lingering effects on the strikers, but that's not what we did. We simply retained our own employees who, by their own actions of abandoning the strike, were number one, helping us weather the economic storm, and number two, illustrated a lack of support for the union's bargaining demands.
How can you be sure that the second conclusion is self-evident? I understand the first one about it obviously helps the employer weather by the very fact that they return to work.
Sure. I'm out of time.
But not knowing the individual circumstances of those decisions, how can you draw the second conclusion that they have abandoned the position of the union?
Well, Judge Flom, if you're willing to abandon a picket line and cross a picket line, by the way, I assume I have cross a picket line of your coworkers, that does tend to indicate that you no longer support the union's bargaining demands. The union's brief.
Well, you don't support by personally committing yourself to staying out. I just don't know how.